We are Missouri Farm Bureau Insurance, and we're for the people of Missouri. We're for brewmasters, stockbrokers, beauty queens, and truck drivers. Whatever you do, if you're a Missourian, we're for you. We are Missouri Farm Bureau Insurance, and we've got Missouri covered.
Garrettson and Toth presents The Shift with Jack Johnson on ESPN Kansas City, 1510 AM and 94.5 FM.
We are back with another edition of The Shift on 94.5 FM and 1510 AM ESPN Kansas City. I am your host, Jack Johnson, alongside Marco Marquez. Shout out to our presenting sponsors, starting with Garrettson and Toth. They handle the most complex felony, federal, or state criminal defense cases. You'll find them in doing that successfully, helping criminal defendants all over the Kansas City area and Northeast Kansas for years. Also, a shout out to Active Family Chiropractic. If you're dealing with any neck, back, shoulder, or any type of pain, go in today and schedule an appointment. Their office is located on 135th and Antioch in Overland Park, Kansas. Or just give them a call at 913-681-6013. That's 913-681-6013. Stop dealing with those nagging pains that keep you up at night and call Active Family Chiropractic today. It's been about 4 or 5 days since we've been back on the air. I was out of town in Las Vegas. Certainly a fun time, but what I didn't get the opportunity to do, at least on 1510 here, is talk a little bit about Tyreek Hill's comments toward Patrick Mahomes and Tua Tagovailoa. Now, we know what Tyreek Hill is doing, trying to promote his podcast. We know that he wants to have not necessarily offensive comments, but inflammatory comments that he knows will get buzz. You generate buzz when you're trying to promote your own podcast. If you said the stuff that everybody believes in, then I think the podcast would not last very long. But what Tyreek Hill is doing, at least what we've seen in these couple of trailers, these small clips, the first couple episodes, is that he wants people to interact by not only pumping up Tua Tagovailoa, but also making it seem like maybe the last year in Kansas City was not what he believed it would be, basically. You know, he's going to come out and say that he wanted to stay in Kansas City. But then as the comment about suppressing his stats, though he had a career high in targets, he had his second straight 1,200-yard season in Kansas City. So the stats were not suppressed, but people are going to talk about it. And whether you believe he's way off, we're talking about it. We are generating buzz. But at the end of the day, we do have to talk about something like this because it is news. It's the offseason. The Royals are not good. The Chiefs haven't started really training camp yet. We're still, I want to say now it's June 12th, so we're still about 3 months away from the home opener. So there needs to be things said about this podcast that Tyreek Hill has. Now, I think people could sort of dispute the fact that Tyreek Hill's final season was suppressed by the Chiefs so that they wouldn't have to pay him as much money, but I think anybody with eyes could tell that that was just simply not the truth. Maybe there were some games where Tyreek Hill didn't get the ball as much as he'd like to, but being a number one wide receiver, you always want the ball. You know, you want to be that receiver that's targeted 12, 13 times a game. It just can't happen like that. You know, you're going to have to spread around the ball. You can't just force feed one guy all game long. But the quote that maybe caught my eye even more than that was about accuracy. So here is what Tyreek Hill had to say about accuracy when comparing Patrick Mahomes to his new quarterback, Tua Tagovailoa.
Right. Who got the strongest arm? Tua or Pat Mahomes? Tua or Patrick Mahomes? Obviously, like, I'm going to go with 1-5 as the strongest arm, but as far as accuracy-wise, I'm going with Tua all day.
So which one would you rather have? The deep ball where you got to scramble around the field to try to go find it? Or do you want that accuracy to hit you right in the bread basket on the run?
I want it to hit me right in the bread basket, just like I did in the Buffalo Bills game and take it 70. And the rest is history.
And again, this is not a shot at anybody.
Right.
This is just stuff that had to be said.
It needed to be said.
That was Tyreek Hill on his podcast talking about who has the stronger arm, who has the more accurate ball, basically. I don't think it's really too much of a shock that Patrick Mahomes, having one of the most talented arms we've ever seen in the NFL, is going to be picked over Tua when talking about arm strength. But, man, through practice, I mean, maybe Tua is a much better practice player than he is on the field on Sundays, because There's a difference between being accurate and being a quarterback that takes chances. And here's the thing about this, is that Tua has never really taken any chances in his NFL career. He does not air the ball out. He can't. He has to keep it within 10 yards, and that's fine. Some quarterbacks are just like that. But the reason maybe Patrick Mahomes' accuracy stats, number one, are maybe not as high. I think Good Morning Football put out a stat that in throws over 20 yards, Tua's accuracy is 50%, Mahomes is 38%. Well, let's go back on this, that in his career, Patrick Mahomes has played one season longer than Tua. He also throws the ball 20-plus yards down the field way more often than Tua does. I could maybe count on my hand the amount of times I've seen Tua throw the ball 20 yards in the air. So, yeah, it might be something like 10 of 20 or 20 of 40. I need to go back and see the actual numbers on that because the Good Morning Football just put out the percentages on that. But you can already tell with it. It's just like a shooting percentage, right? There's going to be times when you look at maybe a shooting percentage of LeBron James from beyond the arc and somebody that has 100 games in their career. Well, yeah, it may be a higher percentage for the guy with 100 games, but are you going to take them over LeBron James? That's just an obvious comment here, and I know that they're just providing some context because Tyreek Hill can't really say that without knowing really why that stat is the way it is, because Tua doesn't air it out. And believe me, I think Tua and Tyreek Hill, they may get along now. You haven't played any games yet, but when you start rolling into week three, week four, and all Tyreek Hill can really do is just give me the ball 5 yards out and I'll try to take it to the house. I mean, yeah, it's going to work one or two times, but Tua is just not the right pairing for Tyreek Hill, and he's really taken a step down when going from an MVP quarterback and one that's won a Super Bowl to Tua, who had 16 touchdowns and 10 picks last year. I mean, it's night and day. Now, the one thing, though, with his podcast and being in Miami is that you want to hype up your quarterback, right? And he's coming from one of the best quarterbacks in the league, so he's not going to come on his podcast and just start trashing his new quarterback. Now, at the end of the day, I'm not necessarily agreeing with the way he's going about not trashing Kansas City, but not talking highly of Kansas City. I think that is a little bit uncalled for because at the end of the day, the Chiefs gave Tyreek Hill many chances to restart his career and restart his life. And it starts with drafting him, right? Nobody was going to draft Tyreek Hill, and the Chiefs decided, okay, we're going to take a chance on you. Then there was the off-field incident a couple years into his career, and the Chiefs still gave him another chance. So I don't necessarily agree with bad-mouthing him the way they are, suppressing his stats, calling them out for suppressing his stats. I mean, let's be real here. I don't think anybody looked at the Chiefs last year and thought, man, they might not be throwing Tyreek Hill the ball enough. There were games when the offense was struggling where they couldn't get him to the ball a lot, but also at the same time, talking about accuracy, I think Tyreek Hill had three or four passes this year that hit him in the numbers, and he dropped it, and I think half of them resulted in an interception. So is Mahomes the most accurate quarterback in the NFL? No. But when you're talking about talent here, I mean, I think debating accuracy between these quarterbacks and arm strength is not really the way to go about it. I just say, who's more talented? It's not even close. It's Tua is a quarterback that, at least out of college, I thought he could fit nicely in the right system. But Alabama quarterbacks, this is also what Blake Schneider says as well, they get a bad rep because they have not performed the way you'd expect them to coming out of Alabama. But at Alabama, the quarterback has never really been the focal point. They have the top running backs, they have the top wide receivers, they have the top offensive line, they've got the top defensive players, but it doesn't really matter who's taking snaps at quarterback. Like, if I was just thrown into Alabama's offense and I never threw a single pass, I just handed the ball off, their coaching is this good, their offensive line is this good, their players are this good at blocking, their skill position players, everything, that if I just handed the ball off over and over again, I guarantee you I could win a couple of games. They're just that much better than everybody else. So they can make quarterbacks great, but when you get to the league, you do have to separate yourself from the others. Tua has not separated himself from the rest of the league. He's one of the bottom quarterbacks in this league. Now maybe with another weapon and Tyreek Hill, he's got Jalen Waddle. I think Mike Gesicki's still there at tight end. But, okay, this is his year, though. This has to be his year because Miami's not going to give him another chance. So I think all this promotion for Tua, it could be a very good thing. It could be a very bad thing. Because if we are talking Tua of this much where you're comparing accuracy and Tyreek Hill, who's played for both at least in practice so far, him saying Tua is more accurate and he'd take him all day, I mean, it wasn't even close. It was, I'm taking Tua all day. I mean, we'll have to wait and see just if Tua can live up to these expectations. I mean, Marco, I think based off promotion, Tyreek Hill's doing an excellent job with his podcast, and I think he knows that. It's not necessarily trolling because it's his opinion. He can say whatever he wants. It's his podcast. But are sometimes we just getting a little bit irritated at this point because we didn't expect Tyreek Hill to have these words for Kansas City, or is it just him trying to maybe promote Miami and he's being told, really try to promote Miami and make it seem like you wanted to be here. Now you're happier in Miami than you were in Kansas City.
So are you asking, like, if...
Is he promoting this podcast in a way of, I want to make Miami seem like it's a very good spot to be right now, and though I wanted to be in Kansas City, mm-hmm. I'm much happier now that I'm in Miami.
I don't know. I don't think necessarily he's promoting it to where he, like you said, he's loving Miami and he wanted to be in Kansas City, but he's happy in Miami. I don't know. It's very he contradicts himself quite a bit throughout the 50 minutes of the episode. Now he doesn't talk. Now all the focus isn't on him necessarily throughout that time. He has his agent Drew Rosenhaus. Is the third person included in this podcast. As somebody who was listening, I think Tyreek Hill ended up getting what he did, what he wanted, which was financial security, being somewhere close with his family, because he talked about how much being by his family matters and how much he loves his family. And then, of course, now, and this is quoting Drew Rosenhaus, he is the face of the franchise down in Miami. He is the highest paid player on the team. He is kind of the focus point this whole offseason, the biggest addition, and they've added a lot of good players, good pieces to this team, but he's by far the biggest name that they've added so far during the free agency period, during offseason. Yeah, I think that he is I think this was obviously a good episode to kick off the podcast with, because we obviously saw how much noise he generated just from the teaser video alone. But now I think he is I don't think he thinks this necessarily, but I'm in my opinion, I think he's in over his head a little bit, because he, like I said, he contradicts himself quite a bit in this one. He talks about how he would have taken less than how much Miami gave him in Kansas City. The amount that they were offering was still a number that he didn't like. He said that he didn't want he was fine with not being the guy on the team, being the franchise player on this roster and not getting paid like a franchise player. But then he says, now in Miami, he gets to do whatever he wants. He compared organizations, saying with Kansas City, he really didn't get to do as much. They had him stay in Kansas City. Like he had talked about when his grandpa had gotten sick, that Kansas City didn't let him go down to go see him. As far as what was said in those conversations with him and the Chiefs organization when that came up, as far as him taking some time of leave, we didn't get any clearance as to what was said there, the reasoning as to why he couldn't go down, like why he couldn't go visit his sick grandpa. But then he said in Miami he can talk to Coach McDaniel, and if he wants to do something, they'll let him do it, basically. So it's a lot of pointing of fingers to both sides and saying things about both sides, but it's not really any clear, because he says one thing, then says the other, which kind of defeats the first thing that he says throughout the podcast. And it happens multiple times. It just doesn't happen one time. This is something that occurs over the course of the show. But excellent choice. Hey, Drew Owens now said it. His profile has gone up since joining Miami, and I am not surprised by that, because bigger market, Tyreek is considered a top five receiver in the league. He's a high profile name throughout the league. So I had no doubt that once he got to Miami, there was going to be a bigger the camera was going to be on him, or is going to be on him. And what he's chose to done with it, he's capitalizing, of course, on it. And so I think that that's more so what this is, what this project of his really is. Now, I'm not going to tune in as a regular listener. I'll tune in if there's something Chiefs-wise, something that's related to the local teams. But props to him. He knew what he was doing, dropping this podcast as the opener to Need to Be Said, and he's going to make some money off it. But at the end of the day, I would take what he says with as far as when it comes to talking about the Chiefs with just with a grain of salt.
And I think that maybe what we're not really taking into account here is that words like this are always going to be said when money was a major disputing factor. Like, if Tyreek Hill was coming up on being a free agent and the Chiefs were just like, we're not going to pay you that. We can't pay you that. You're 34, 35. Now, like, when Travis Kelce comes up on his free agent spot, if they even get to that point, maybe the Chiefs extend it. But let's say he does. Let's say he becomes a free agent. He's past his prime. And maybe Noah Gray. Noah Gray or Jody Fortson, or they've drafted another tight end that's really playing well early on, and you know that the Chiefs want to transition to getting a younger tight end. I don't think Travis Kelce would have bad things to say about Kansas City. Now, different players, too. I think when you look at the way Patrick Mahomes handles himself, Travis Kelce and Tyreek Hill all did, I think they all had different personalities in the way they'd react to this. And I know in that podcast that Tyreek Hill mentioned that he wanted to be treated like Patrick Mahomes. And the reality of it is that, excuse me, I got a problem with my voice today just from a long weekend. But the problem with that is that Patrick Mahomes has a much different trajectory coming out of the draft, or had a much different trajectory than Tyreek Hill did. Like, Tyreek Hill could never be the face of Kansas City because of the off-field problems there were. Now, and then it happened nearly again, and he was in the news again for a very similar reason, a couple years down the road. So Patrick Mahomes, having a father that played in the major leagues, you know, being around clubhouses, being a first-round pick, being a quarterback, you know, being out in the public lot, not saying Tyreek Hill wasn't, but they just grabbed onto that immediately because it was, here's this quarterback. The Chiefs have never had a franchise quarterback. He's a guy that a lot of us saw in the Big 12 playing, so you had that close to him. I know Tyreek Hill was at Oklahoma State for a year or two and also was at Garden City Community College, but they just had two different paths. And promoting a quarterback and paying a quarterback, teams are much more willing to do that than they are with wide receivers, especially nowadays. And they gave Patrick Mahomes that contract after he'd won a Super Bowl, after he'd won an MVP, and he was 25 years old. Like, the Chiefs were not going to give Tyreek Hill that money because he is getting up there in age for a wide receiver. He's still young. He's still under 30. But at the end of this contract in Miami, if he's still there at the time, they're going to be paying him a lot of money for a guy that's going to be 32, 33. Can he be as explosive as he is now than at age 33 or 34? I mean, we'll have to wait and see on that. But it's going to happen like that with players, especially when you're so successful. You can't make everybody happy. Like, for instance, we talked about this a few times with Chris Jones. If Chris Jones is traded next year, I don't know what the reaction would be. We've seen Chris Jones be feisty and a little fired up at times of talking about contracts. Remember when he wasn't getting the deal, he was being very cryptic on Twitter, and we thought, okay, maybe Chris Jones is not going to stay in Kansas City because he really wants that money. Trading, though, is also different. And the way that Chris Jones will be traded as opposed to Tyreek Hill. Now, last question I want to ask to you, Marco, about this situation is, we know Miami's not coming to Kansas City this year unless it's in the postseason. I don't think Miami makes the postseason. I think next year the Chiefs are, I think, potentially scheduled to play the AFC East. Now, that would mean, no, well, they just played him in the COVID year, didn't they? They played Miami because Tua and Mahomes have played each other. They played down in Miami, and it was a high-scoring game.
They played the AFC North this last year. They played the AFC South this year.
So it is the AFC East next year.
Yes.
And it will be in Kansas City because they played in Miami last time around.
Perhaps. Sometimes it doesn't always work like
that. That's
true.
Okay, I'm going to ask you this question because I think that after a year off and after this podcast sort of dies down in terms of talk about the Chiefs and more about Miami.
In fact, Hill's moving on from sports. His next guest he wants to have on is, I think he's going down to, he wants to talk to hip-hop artists from, the 90s.
So this will, this will just be news for now, then probably die off a little bit. Yeah. But from these comments and from now how some fans are having a bad taste in their mouth about Tyreek Hill, if Miami were to play in Kansas City, let's say early on this season, which is obviously not happening, the schedule's out, but let's just say it did, would Tyreek Hill be received poorly by the Arrowhead crowd?
Yes.
You think they would boo Tyreek Hill at this point?
Yes. I think they would. I think they would, yes.
What about, let's say, now, so not only, let's say this is a possibility, though I don't believe it to be a strong possibility. Let's say the Chiefs play the Dolphins in the AFC divisional round. They win the AFC West and then host Miami in the divisional round. It's been a couple of months since then, but that's still our lasting thought of Tyreek Hill is the comments he's been saying in the podcast and speaking maybe ill of Kansas City. Do they boo him in the postseason or is time elapsed enough where we don't really care too much at that point?
Nope. He's getting booed for the remainder of his career in Kansas City.
Really?
Yeah, I mean, I think that it's not a sincere hate boo, but it's a, if you, whenever you sit around with your friends, you guys, you ever cuss at each other? You'd be like, you M blanking you piece of S, but it's all out of love.
Yeah.
It's going to be boos out of love.
A fun boo, not like a pure hatred boo. Cause this is not the first time a Chiefs player has left and not been too happy about the way in which they left, or Justin Houston was not happy and still has bad feelings towards Kansas City by the way they went about it. Jamal Charles, when the Chiefs eventually cut him, because he was cut at the tail end. I can't remember if they cut him or they just let him walk because he had battled the ACL injuries the last couple of years in Kansas City.
He wasn't cut
or they let him walk. And then when he signed with Denver, he was like, I've always wanted to wear a Denver uniform. But Jamal Charles was not Jamal Charles anymore. If Jamal Charles was in the prime of his career and somehow left Kansas City and went to Denver, he may have had the boos coming towards him at Arrowhead Stadium. Since Tyreek Hill is still a top five wide receiver in this league and Miami came to Kansas City, you would feel, maybe some fans would feel the need to boo. If Tyreek Hill was 37 years old and then spoke ill of Kansas City, you'd be like, that kind of sucks because he's been here his entire career in Kansas City.
Right.
But he's not going to be the type of player where he could take over the game and beat you. Tyreek Hill still has that power. But I was curious because we asked this question not long ago, right after he was traded to Miami, and we kind of thought, he wanted to be paid highly, but he didn't. He wanted to stay in Kansas City, but he wanted more money than really to stay in Kansas City. And I asked you, do they boo him? And you said, no, I don't see them booing him because he wanted money, he got paid, that's fine with him. But then when these comments come out, it maybe switches to, man, now you're talking about Patrick Mahomes, now you're talking about Andy Reid, now you're talking about the front office, and you're very open about it. I think a lot of Chiefs fans, knowing the fan base a little bit, they can react to that poorly. And so when Tyreek Hill is announced in the game, I think some fans are definitely going to turn on Tyreek Hill, not in a pure hatred way, because I don't think you can hate Tyreek Hill for what he was able to accomplish in Kansas City. It sucks to know that maybe this is coming out after you kind of felt like they were all a tight brotherly bond, and I think they still are. Sure, Mahomes and Kelce and Hill, they talk every day, but I'd be interested to hear what Mahomes had to say. Now, he's a A-plus student when it comes to talking to the media. You know, Mahomes is never going to snap back and say, no, I made Tyreek Hill the receiver today. It's just not Patrick Mahomes. Kelce's not like that, or at least not like that anymore. So maybe it's the maturity aspect. Not saying Tyreek Hill's immature. I just think he likes being in the media. He likes that type of attention. Nothing wrong with that. He's not the only player in the NFL that likes attention. But I thought these comments were definitely interesting on his podcast. But like you said, he's done talking about sports. There will be a long layoff before Kansas City is brought up in his podcast again. At least I believe that to be the case. But yeah, when Miami comes to Kansas City, either that be in the postseason this year or next year, maybe if they go to Miami, I'm interested in how fans will receive Tyreek Hill. You say they boo him. I think it'll be about 50-50. I think it'll be that mix of cheering and booing. I am fascinated, though, by that possibility. I can't wait till Miami does come to Kansas City and hoping Tyreek Hill is still there and playing well in his prime for that game. We are going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll be talking some Royals baseball as they split their four-game series against Baltimore over the weekend. You're listening to The Shift on 94.5 FM and 1510 AM ESPN Kansas City. Welcome back into The Shift on 94.5 FM and 1510 AM ESPN Kansas City. I am your host, Jack Johnson, alongside Marco Marquez. Marco, I don't know if you saw this. It was on Sunday Night Baseball last night, and it was kind of sad to hear. You feel bad for a guy, especially for a decorated manager like Joe Maddon. I mean, won a lot of games as a manager, but he was canned after the Angels had lost 14 games in a row. But that's not the sad part of this story, and that really should be in most cases, right? 14 games in a row when you're losing. We think it's been bad in Kansas City. It's still worse in Kansas City than it is in Anaheim right now. But, man, the Royals don't have Mike Trout. They also don't have Ohtani. They don't have Anthony Rendon. And that Angels team lost 14 games in a row. But before they eventually snapped that losing streak, the Angels were trying everything in their power to find some superstition and use it to win a baseball game. Like, I think when they lost 13 in a row, they decided that every single player would walk up to a Nickelback song, walk up to the plate. Their walk-up song would be a Nickelback song. They lost 1-0, so they didn't score. You trash that idea. So Joe Maddon decided on the day that he was fired, he was going to get a mohawk. He cut his hair and got a mohawk, but the players never saw it because he was fired. So they're talking about this on Sunday Night Baseball, that even Joe Maddon, he's trying to be fun, try to get that superstition, keep the clubhouse light and happy, cuts his own hair into a mohawk, right? And Joe Maddon's, what, upper 60s? Might be in his 70s at this point.
Right, right. He's full white hair.
Full white hair. He's been white hair for a long time. So I'd imagine he's up there, upper 60s, maybe 70s. I could be way off. Just feels like Joe Maddon's been around the game for a long time, and he was older when he took over as the Rays manager anyway. But trying to be fun and cutting his hair into a mohawk, the players never got to see it. So now he's jobless and has a mohawk, unless he decided to shave the rest of the mohawk. I don't know. But I'm like, it kind of makes you feel sad a little bit that they could have at least called him, I don't know, after loss 13. I know that the Angels front office didn't know that he cut his hair into a mohawk. I hope they didn't. Well, no, he would have had to go into the office looking like that. They probably called him into the office, set up a meeting, and he had a mohawk on.
And I
would at least be like, well, can I at least go to the clubhouse and tell the guys? I'm sure maybe he did get the ability to, but at least on Sunday Night Baseball, like, he said it was, I want to say it was John Morosi's story. And he was talking about, yeah, the players never saw it. So I don't think he got to go down to the clubhouse unless it was maybe late at night when they decided to fire him after the game. Not sure, but oh, that's just rough to do, man.
Yeah, I get.
There are worse things that can happen, right? And I'm sure that he was just more upset about being fired. But there's another manager right there. There was another manager right after Joe Girardi that was fired for poor performance from his team. But I do commend the Angels for trying to keep it light and keep it fun when you're losing a lot of games, because not a lot of times that come out publicly. Mm-hmm. Right? That doesn't, like, when they're being superstitious, you only find out about it like a week or two after the team's been winning. Like, I want to say the Royals rally mantis in 2016, I want to say it was. The rally mantis wasn't really a thing until the Royals had won like 3 or 4 in a row. Then rally mantis became a story. But those superstition things, they stay kind of undercover until the team has turned it around, because nobody really cares about your superstition type of stuff when you're still losing baseball games. And 14 in a row by the Angels with as much star power as they have, that's unheard of. So I'm not blaming the Angels for firing Joe Maddon. I just kind of feel bad from his manager that he went out of his way to keep the clubhouse light and fun. And if the Angels were keeping winning from that point, there's Joe Maddon, an old manager with the mohawk on. Now, I don't know if the Royals have done anything superstitious-wise. Probably not. I can't imagine there has been, because they have not won many games of late. They have 20 wins on the season, and we are in mid-June. They lost to the Baltimore Orioles yesterday, 10-7. They dropped the 20-39 on the year. Their 10-game homestand comes to a close. They went 4-6 on that homestand against the Toronto Blue Jays, against the Baltimore Orioles, and the Houston Astros. Started it with the Houston Astros, then played the Blue Jays, then played the Orioles for 4. They won the first 2 games against the Baltimore Orioles, then lost the last 2. And here was one of the striking statistics that caught me yesterday. Marco, the Royals have scored 7 or more runs 7 times this season. They do not have a winning record in those games. That's how bad the pitching staff is. And that's how bad the pitching staff can get with the Royals not doing much about it. They're 3-4 in those games, and they score 7 or more runs. They also are one of two teams in baseball this year that are winless. 0-19 when allowing a run, or I think trailing after the first inning. So not much of the comeback kids either. And yes, I could spend the next 10 minutes bashing Cal Eldred for being a bad pitching coach. I'm out of words at this point. I mean, we've just, the Royals are okay with it, and if that's the way they want to roll with it, then so be it. They change pitching coaches here midseason. Maybe some guys make a leap. They change some things, and the Royals pitching staff improves. I can't think it can be much worse at this point. I mean, they could make some small strides, and you still feel much better about the direction of the pitching staff. I mean, look at the Royals' offense. It has been significantly better with Alex Zumwalt and Mike Tosar, though they've been shut out still a few times during that stretch, but then it was with Terry Bradshaw. You feel like they're improving at the plate and doing it in a handful of ways. The pitching staff, I don't know what type of jump it could make, but to sit here continuing to point the finger at Cal Eldred, I kind of feel like it's a moot point. Right? We just kind of can keep criticizing him. We know he's a terrible pitching coach. We know that he had no prior major league pitching coach experience before taking this job, and he's been here for 5 years. So, yeah, I'm with the public here. I'm with the majority in that Cal Eldred shouldn't be in Kansas City. In fact, he stayed about 4 years too long. But if they haven't done it at this point, what makes me think they're going to do it today, tomorrow, and a month from now, 2 months? I don't think he's the pitching coach next year. I think the Royals are smart enough to know that this pitching staff is abysmal and it shouldn't be this bad. I mean, the Royals pitching staff is just a disaster, an absolute disaster. The Baltimore Orioles scored 10 runs yesterday and had 3 home runs off Brad Keller in 2 innings. Keller didn't make it out of the second inning. And you remember, we were talking about, including myself, I said this, that Cal Eldred's biggest success, it's not my words, I was regurgitating it from what the Kansas City media had said, that, you know, Cal Eldred's biggest success story has been Brad Keller. Because Brad Keller's only pitching coach at the big league level has been Cal Eldred. And for being a Rule 5 pick, we felt like, okay, maybe he did hit the nail on the head with Brad Keller. Brad Keller's 1-8 this year with a 4.74 ERA. And if that's your biggest success story, oh boy, that pitching staff must be pretty bad. Now, the positives I am seeing, and I feel like under different coaching, a lot of these young guys can make a significant stride. Daniel Lynch, for one, I think can make a massive step forward next season with somebody else going through drills with him, going through bullpens with him. I think we can see a big change from not only Lynch, but from Bubich, but from Heasley, from Singer, down the road. I think you can see a big jump from those guys, which is why for now, all I really want to see is just the stuff is there. The stuff is there, and with the right coach, you can tap into that type of potential. We've seen it with the Giants. Jake Junis had great stuff, and the Giants went and said, okay, here's how we're going to change things up. You're going to throw your slider most of the time, and he was great before he eventually hurt himself on, I want to say it was Friday night. Yeah, Friday night, Junis actually walked off the mound after hurting his hamstring a little bit. He was supposed to face the Royals on Wednesday of this series because the Royals are facing the Giants in the Bay Area for a 3-game series starting tonight. But that's what you want to see with the Royals next year. It's looking at guys of going, okay, they've got the stuff. Brady Singer absolutely has the stuff. But it's about correcting a thing or two here, 3 or 4 things here. Then you can really see that pitcher take a tremendous step forward. And for the rest of the year, I don't care if the Royals lose 110 games. I really don't. You know, for the players, I would feel for the players to trudge through a 110 loss season. But you want to see the type of players, the young guys who will be here for the next couple of years, have the stuff still. Right? If Daniel Lynch goes out there and he's flipping in 92, 93 mile an hour fastballs, can't locate his slider, not throwing his changeup, and he's getting hammered for 8 runs in 2 innings, then yeah, I'm like, well, maybe he is unfixable at this point. I don't think any of these young guys are unfixable. But with the right coaching, man, we really can see why they would be first or second round picks. Like Jackson Coar, I think, has the stuff. It's more of a mental thing at the big league level. And for the rest of the year, I don't know how much damage it'll do to these pitchers for having Cal Eldred be the pitching coach for the remaining parts of this season. It's not going to make them better, I'll tell you that. But if they can overcome that coaching with just pure talent, winning on talent alone, it's tough to do, and it's tough to do in Kansas City. But over this last weekend, I feel like there are strides being made by the pitching staff, but not the strides that you know are going to be long-term. Like John Heasley, was phenomenal on Friday night. Seven innings, one hit, actually. Shut out the Orioles over seven innings. And you feel good about John Heasley, right? You may not see John Heasley as a long-term piece in this rotation, but it's nice to see guys from that 2018 draft class thrive in the way they did, at least for a couple times over the weekend. Then Daniel Lynch on Saturday afternoon was great until Cal Eldred visited the mound. I think it was through five innings at that point, only one earned run. Gives up a three-run bomb to Tyler Nevin right after the mound visit from Cal Eldred. I don't know what he tells him on the mound. I don't think there is more of a obvious thing that happens than following a mound visit from Cal Eldred, a Royals pitcher just completely collapses. And you see, time and time again, when the Royals are facing other teams, when pitching coaches go out to the mound, it usually benefits them. They get a double play ball, they get a strikeout and a pop-up. It works out in that way. I don't remember a time where Cal Eldred has visited the mound and it's resulted in a positive thing for Royals pitchers. So I don't know what's being said. Maybe they're listening to him, maybe they're not. But who cares at this point? We've seen it over and over again. Clearly, the Royals don't think too much of it. They just think, well, that's bad luck right there. Well, okay. If you believe it's bad luck, 40 losses, I guess, are all bad luck when you look at the Kansas City Royals. But for this homestand, it could have been much worse. I thought they could have gone 2-8 by who they were playing. They went 4-6. They won at least a game in each parts of these series. They weren't really competitive with the Astros, aside from their one win. Same thing with the Blue Jays. I thought they could win the series against Baltimore, but dropping those last two off of bad pitching, I mean, it's telling. That's how the Royals have lost games this year. Now they'll take on the San Francisco Giants for a three-game set in the Bay Area. They will be beginning their West Coast road trip. But when I look at this team, and you're trying to find positives, you're trying to find a light with this team, I don't think you have to look much further than what Bobby Witt Jr. has done after those first 10 games in which he really struggled. I mean, we've seen some dips, we've seen some ups and downs, but he's pacing right now for a 23 home run season and 28 stolen bases. His WAR will probably be around 2-3, would be my best guess, if he continues this type of trend. He was 3-4 yesterday, crushing the ball at the plate. I mean, his exit velo has to be the best on the Royals, I want to say, at this point. Crushed one, I think, 113 the other day. I think it was in two and out, but the kid is phenomenal, and you know that the star power is absolutely there, and he is going to be the Royals' best player 2 years from now. I don't think maybe next year he could be this team's best player. Right now you could argue that he is the best player. I know the average is still not where it needs to be, but I look at more of the advanced analytical numbers when evaluating Bobby Witt Jr. His WRC plus is north of 100 at this point. At least it has been. He's at, I think, in the last 10 games, Bobby Witt Jr. has just been phenomenal. I mean, the numbers have been ridiculous, and if he continues this trend for the next month or two, he will be back in Rookie of the Year conversation over Jeremy Peña of the Houston Astros. But the numbers are just, they're bonkers almost to an extent where you feel like he can hit those strides and hit them well, because we saw the one where he had the 13-14-game hitting streak, right? You could see he was hitting the ball hard. Those balls that he was hitting hard in the first 20 games of the year, they were now finding the outfield grass. He's hitting with power. He's running the bases well. He's getting on base more. His strikeout numbers are lowering a little bit. But in his last 10 games, he's hitting over 350. His WRC plus is north of 130. And that's from your shortstop. And now they've moved him to shortstop permanently because Adalberto Mondesi is not healthy. They've just moved Nicky Lopez over to second base. So the long-term plan for Bobby Witt Jr., I guess, now is shortstop and not third base. It just feels like, once again, with an entire season, maybe an offseason with Alex Zumwalt, Mike Tosar, working with these hitters, and maybe there's a new hitting coach for next season, but you want to make sure these young hitters, they're in the right hands. Because same thing with the young pitchers. We know they're in the wrong hands right now. In fact, they're the worst change you could possibly be in Major League Baseball. There's no pitching coach out there less qualified to handle these pitchers than Cal Eldred is. I think they've got the right voices now with Alex Zumwalt and Mike Tosar, especially when Vinny Pasquantino and Nick Prado make their way to Kansas City. But right now, I think in this developmental phase, we're seeing this is what Bobby Witt Jr. can do and MJ Melendez can do when they're on a terrible baseball team, but they still have that talent. They have this immense talent that maybe we haven't seen in Kansas City for a long, long time. And Bobby Witt Jr., it's refreshing to see that even in a year like this, and even in a year where he is expected to shoulder a lot of the offensive workload, just based off of how some guys have performed in this lineup, it's very refreshing to see. Because a 21-year-old should not have to have that type of offensive pressure in a lineup, hitting third. but we're seeing what he's capable of doing. And I can only imagine once he gets the legitimate protection behind him in the lineup, has got like 5 or 6, 7 guys that can really hit in this lineup, who knows what his numbers are capable of being. MVP level, all-star level, don't know at this point. Still way too early to call that for Bobby Wood Jr., but I think we are seeing that, man, even in a year like this, for as bad as the offense has been, he has been one of the main bright spots, and he's only getting better to this point. And I think two years from now, we will understand why these scouts called him a can't-miss prospect. There were two guys in that draft that scouts said, it doesn't matter where they go, they're going to be stars in this league. It was Bobby Wood Jr. and Adley Rutschman, who was just here with Baltimore over the weekend. But I still think the ceiling for Bobby Wood Jr. is much, much higher than it is for Adley Rutschman. We are going to take our final break. When we come back, we'll be talking some NBA Finals as the Boston Celtics and Warriors are tied up 2 games apiece. Or excuse me, yeah, I'm 2 games apiece at this point, right? I think game 5 is... Mm-hmm.
Tonight at 8.
Tonight, that's right. I was like, hoping I didn't miss it on Sunday night because I went to bed very early last night after the long weekend. So yes, 2-2 in the series right now. Golden State was able to win in the Garden in game 4, but it'll be game 5 tonight. In the Bay Area, Warriors a 3.5-point favorite over under at 210.5. We will get into all that and preview it when we come back here. You're listening to The Shift on 94.5 FM and 1510 AM ESPN Kansas City. Welcome back into The Shift on 94.5 FM and 1510 AM ESPN Kansas City. I am your host, Jack Johnson, alongside Marco Marquez. So I'm glad I didn't miss some imaginary game last night because I went to bed around 7 last night. It was a very long weekend. But the cool thing about this was, have you ever been to Las Vegas, Marco?
Yes, but not over the age of 21.
Okay. So on Friday night, we went to Stadium Swim, which is this really, really cool, basically party pool type of atmosphere. They got these huge screens, right? It's like a giant jumbotron with any game imaginable that's on. There were 5 or 6 baseball games on. There was a couple of college baseball games in the Super Regionals. And then at, I guess, Vegas time, it was 6 o'clock when this happened, they put on game 4 of the NBA Finals. I had bet on that game. I had bet on the Warriors to win that game. And the cool thing about it is in Vegas, right, at this pool area, is a predominantly a large chunk of sports fan, but everybody was zoned into this game because everybody had money on this game. So it's on the big screen. They had the volume going and everything, and on the commercial breaks, they were playing loud club-type music. So we were there from like 5 to 11. And for that game alone, right, people had bets in the first quarter.
Yeah.
People had bets on Steph Curry, on Jordan Poole, on Jaylen Brown, on Robert Williams. Everybody, it was like the craziest thing I've seen because I just bet on the game. I'm like, I don't want to have to put up that much money on small type of bets where I may walk away down, right? I want at least count on the Warriors, who I don't think are going behind 3-1, to win this basketball game. And, you know, at times there was 14 of us on this trip. So we had this large chunk of groups. And so then everybody kind of realized who was rooting for the Warriors, who was rooting for the Celtics. Now, there were fans there as well.
Right.
Wearing Warriors jerseys, wearing Boston jerseys, but 90% of them were all just betters, betting on this game.
Vegas, baby.
Vegas, baby. So at the end of this, there was a clear divide of about 35 people that were betting on the Warriors and like 25, a little bit less, for the Boston Celtics. But people were loud. And the best part about this is it was a close game.
Yeah.
But the NBA postseason has not generated a lot of close games. And the fact that it was down to this, like 1 2-point game in the final minute or so, or I guess it was not the final, it was like final 3 minutes, I want to say it was, because then the Warriors did end up pulling away because of the sheer magic type of powers that Steph Curry possesses. I mean, we'll never see anything like Steph Curry again, just like we'll never see another LeBron James in this league again. But I think what really caught my eye in this series, the basketball standpoint here, is that really it is game one of why we're at this point. Because Golden State proved in game 4 here that the experience mattered, right? The having that postseason experience mattered to win games like this. If Steph Curry's not on this team, number one, the Warriors aren't in the NBA Finals, but having him, Klay, and Draymond, though Draymond was not good on Friday night, having that experience over Jason Tatum and Jaylen Brown showed a lot in game 4. The Celtics completely collapsed. They did not know what to do when the Warriors were thriving in that moment with Jordan Poole on the floor, or Steph Curry and Klay Thompson all together on the floor at the same time. Jason Tatum looked totally different. Jaylen Brown looked totally different. Even Marcus Smart looked totally different. It's why the Warriors were able to pull away in the way that they did. But going back to that game one, if the Warriors didn't collapse, this would not be a close series. This would not really be a competitive series, it feels like. Though the Boston Celtics won game three, I don't know if they win game three if they don't win game one. Mm-hmm. Because the Warriors collapsing in the way they did gave the hope that Boston goes, man, they're not as good as you may think they are. That experience doesn't matter. But then we always felt like experience was going to show up for Golden State at some point in this series, just didn't know when. And the way they were able to win game four was, in my opinion, from Steph Curry alone, because Steph Curry was ridiculous, but having the experience that Steph Curry has in the finals. They knew that they fall behind 3-1, it's likely that series could be over. They're not going to be able to overcome the way I think the Warriors were when they collapsed against Cleveland. I didn't see that series going the same way. I feel like if Boston won that game, Boston was going to win the series, just up 3-1. I'm not a genius in saying that, because 3-1 series leads, they're usually not blown unless you have a LeBron James on the floor. Steph Curry is still one of the best players we've ever seen in the NBA. I just don't give him that same type of power maybe that I can to LeBron. But going into the rest of the series, games 5, 6, and 7, the last two, or at least two of the last three, will be at Golden State. Game 6 will be in Boston. So going into tonight, what I'd expect at least out of Golden State in the Bay Area is that, man, that it feels like this could be one of those, I guess, step games on the throat. Well, pivotal, I don't want to say must win. It is a must win. It's a step on the throat type of game. And if Golden State can win and win comfortably tonight, which is why I kind of felt like in game four, if they won comfortably, the series would be over. It was a nail biter. Mm-hmm. But they win tonight in resounding fashion. This series ends in six. This series ends at the Garden, because now Golden State's got all that momentum. That's a crushing loss for Boston in game four. We'll see if they can bounce back tonight in San Francisco. Golden State and Boston will tip off at 8 p.m. on ABC. Warriors a 3.5-point favorite, over under at 210.5. If you're in Vegas still, be sure you're betting on the game tonight and go watch it at Stadium Swim. All right, time for some fact or fiction. 5 questions, 5 takes, under 5 minutes. Marco, fire away.
Jack, fact or fiction, Tyreek Hill leads the AFC East in receiving yards this year.
So his biggest competition will be Stephon Diggs, the Buffalo Bills, right? I'm trying to think. New England has Kendrick Bourne. Kendrick Bourne's not doing it, and then the Jets have Corey Davis. So, quarterback play. I'm going to go fiction on this. I think with Josh Allen and the Stephon Diggs duo, the link-up, the comparison, whatever you want to say, it's just much better than Tua and Tyreek Hill at this point. Maybe I'm wrong, but I'm pretty confident that Josh Allen can have the highest, or the league's leading, or not league's leading, division-leading receiver on Buffalo's offense with Stephon Diggs.
Fact or fiction, Dolphins win at least 9 games.
I'll go fact on this, because I think they have enough talent to get them to 9 games. Is it good enough to get into the postseason in the AFC? It's not going to be, because 9 wins is just, with as tough as it is in the AFC this year, that's just not enough at this point. I don't think any team with less than 10 wins sneaks into the postseason this year, and it definitely won't be Miami.
Fact or fiction, Bobby Witt Jr. finishes with a WRC plus of over 105.
I'm going to go fact on this. I think he's heating up in the way that it's at pretty much the right time for any rookie. You know, I think every rookie this year has struggled, at least early on, but once they get comfortable and the way that he's showing that comfortability at the plate, man, I can only imagine what he can finish the season at. Because if he's hitting the way it is now for an extended period in the rest of June, July, and even if he has a little bit of a dip in August, he's going to have a WRC plus north of 100, because, and 105 for that matter, because he's just that good offensively to play right now, and he's getting even more comfortable. He hasn't even close to reaching his ceiling yet.
Fact or fiction, Witt Jr. finishes with 20 home runs and 25 bags.
He's already at 8. Still months to go here. I'll go fact over 20. Yeah, I'm buying into all the Bobby Witt Jr. juice right now, because this is a type of player I don't think we've seen in Kansas City in a very long time. In a 2020 season and just year one in Kansas City, that'd be phenomenal, but he is phenomenal as well. So fact on that.
And lastly, fact or fiction, the Warriors cover the 4-point spread tonight.
I think they win and do cover tonight. I think it won't be as close as game four. But, yeah, they're not losing 2 games at home in this series. So I'm going to take them to go up 3-2 on the Boston Celtics tonight. There is Ray Charles, so it's time to go. That wraps up another edition of The Shift on 94.5 FM and 1510 AM ESPN Kansas City. I've been your host, Jack Johnson, alongside Marco Marquez. We'll be back tomorrow at 10 a.m. You take it easy, Kansas City.